Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Shot Volume. I'm Nick Ashbourne with Anthony Petrelli, as always. And this week, I wanted to talk a little bit about one of what I think is a little bit of an underreported story in the NHL this year, which is the uptick in penalties and, as a result, power play opportunities. So this year, you're getting about half an opportunity per game per team more than we got last year after many years where it's been fairly stable. Like, it's hovered around three, and now we're talking about 3.57. It's not 2005, 2006. Like, it's not the total chaos, you know, power play is taking over the game type situation, but it is pretty noticeable. And I mean, there are teams that will benefit, there are players that will benefit. But what I want to talk about a little bit today is sort of the game itself. And do you think the game I'll just leave it with that. Do you think the game benefits from an uptick in this power play time?
By and large, I would say no. I think games, we generally want to see them played at 5-on-5. We want to see a flow of lines. Power plays, you get more goals. Obviously, it's easier to score on a power play than your regular run of 5-on-5. I think the best type of games, at least the ones I enjoy, it's not necessarily a 7-6 game that's spiked up by power plays. It's watching teams get into a flow and a rhythm. And, you know, the continuity of hockey is what makes it so exciting, more so than any other of the major sports. Obviously, baseball is top of the inning, bottom of the inning. Football is stop, start. Basketball is the closest, but there's no fluid neutral zone. It's either you're playing offense or you're playing defense. And it's a, you know, it's one end to the other in a much slower fashion. Hockey has the fluidity. So to me, having teams play that the most possible, but then also win the game by and large on the back of that is the ideal type of hockey game.
Yeah, I think that's understandable. A lot of time we talk about the progression of different sports. People tend to think that more offense is beneficial. And it has been in certain sports. But like, if you ask a basketball fan, for instance, like, is the game way better today than it was 20 years ago? You get a lot of different answers. Like, yes, scoring is up, points are up, but is the game itself better? I'm not so sure on the count of basketball. And I think hockey is the same way. Like, I referenced that 2005, 2006 season when like guys like Brian Gionta are going off and becoming becoming superstars, you know, kind of to the average fan because they're just seeing these massive numbers. And that's not where we're going right now, to be clear. I do want to see each team get a couple of power play opportunities in a game. Like, I'm not saying like the referee should force it and do makeup calls and stuff like that. But when I see a team roll through town, like, I want to see their top guns have an opportunity to make some nice plays and set it up. But I think that you're right in that, like, part of what differentiates hockey is that level of flow, you know, is the changes on the fly, right? You don't like see that in basketball. Guys don't, you do in pickup sometimes, but in real NBA basketball, I don't see guys like running onto the court. In baseball, you don't see like a pinch runner joining from in between second and third base. Like, this kind of flow that hockey has is valuable. And I think that when you get a lot of penalties, there's a choppiness to the game too, because those are stoppages in play as well. And face like the, it's mainly about the goals. It's mainly about sort of the offensive zone time and how that changes the game, but also just these stop. Like, sometimes it's nice to have a period where like 8-9 minutes go by and there's just no face off. And it's harder to have that in a world where the game is tightly reffed. And I think you could argue that like the refereeing itself has been a bit of an issue too. Like it, when you're watching, it does seem like there are more of these ticky tacky calls that you'd be happy to see them just go by.
Yeah. Like you lose the rhythm. And I find, especially early in the season, teams are very much working through who goes on after a power play, who goes on after a penalty kill, right? Like they're not set. Once you get to the playoff time, or, you know, even that later stretch of the season, it's automatic for teams, right? It's like the three guys on the bench know we kill this penalty, we're getting the next shift. Right now, it's teams are kind of feeling that process out, which is what the beginning of the season is for, and that's fine. But it just, sometimes I'm watching games right now and I'm sitting there going, like, that last 5 minutes was just, it was weird. It was choppy. It was awkward. We kind of, you know, prior to that penalty, there was actually a flow to the game. Certain lines were going, and it's taking guys time to get back into the game because they were maybe sitting for, you know, 8 minutes in real life, not in game time, but, you know, there's a commercial, whatever the case is. And you kind of lose it a little bit, and it takes a little bit more to get back into it. So I'm weary, but you know, you'll get a lot of people that will also conversely complain that calls weren't made. And it's a little bit of that football.
That's a lot of partisan stuff though. That's a lot of like, my team didn't get the call that they were supposed to get. I don't think a lot of people are like, more penalties in general.
It's the football argument though, of like, every play is a hold. You know, you'll often see something where you're like, I guess they could have called it. You know, like last night, I'm watching the Leaf game, and there was a weak call, I thought, on John Klingberg. He was slashed in the neutral zone. I was like, that's not a penalty. And then in the second period, I watched, and Tyler Bertuzzi, with one hand on a stick, hits someone.
Now, that was a wild call.
And he falls. Like, if you have one hand on your stick and you are above the knee, it's not a trip. Like, it's either it's a dive and you take both, or you just don't call it, but it's definitely not a trip, right? It's like those like ticky tack things where, you know, the Kings might say, well, he fell, it's a trip. And that's what they ended up calling. But, you know, like, are those good penalties? No, I basically want to see the game. Personally, I want to see a game of 5-on-5 as much as possible. And if one team can't keep up with the other team, ergo, they're taking penalties to negate scoring chances or zone time, or they just did something stupid by chance. Like, I just want to see the game played a 5-on-5.
Yeah, I think, you know, Bertuzzi is an interesting example that you mentioned, because like, the game is being called tighter right now, and he's a guy who's sort of a perpetual line stepper. And so he, in his career, he actually has not taken a lot of penalties. Like, people have this perception of him like he's a pest, but his penalties have been pretty low his whole career. And then this year, they're just not. And I don't think that he's like doing something that's radically different. I think it's just that the game is being called in a slightly different way. And there are certain players it's not really going to matter to, but there are certain players who are going to have to adjust to this. And yeah, I think just by and large, I'm in agree with you, right? Like, the game is at its best at 5-on-5. My number, I'm just going to throw out there, I'm going to say two power plays each. If both teams get two power plays, we get to see it. Maybe one's organized, one is not. We get a sense of what it is. Maybe you get a goal out of the whole thing. That's good for me. But right now we're seeing seven power plays a game, and that just feels like a little bit much. You know, that's almost a whole period of power plays.
I was going to say five, so two each and then one extra for the other. Also, we're talking about the Leafs-Kings game just because it happened the night before we recorded this. But I mean, the Heritage Classic was, Edmonton was sitting there in the first, like, what is going on here? Like, we're just, like, these guys are just getting 5-on-3s gifted to them. And I mean, Calgary wasn't cashing them in, but it definitely ruined the flow of that game. Like, to me, that game did not have what I wanted out of it in terms of physicality even and flow of play and anything. It was very stagnant. It felt like Edmonton got a lead and then was killing penalties, and Calgary was getting gifted opportunities to get back into the game and they weren't cashing it in. It just, that's not the showcase of hockey I would want to see, especially on a stage like that.
Anthony, I know that you've been watching, I think, like quite a few people, to be honest, the Kyle Dubas experience going on in Pittsburgh right now. Like, not a lot of teams had a huge offseason overhaul, to be honest, this year. I mean, that's partly that kind of flat cap world we've lived in, where a lot of teams just aren't able to make a ton of moves. The Pittsburgh Penguins did. The early results are not good, and my understanding is that you are especially unimpressed with what you're seeing.
Yeah, so they are an interesting sort of conundrum. So they are 29th in points percentage, which obviously a tough start where, you know, they haven't even hit the 10 game mark. So there's of course a ton of time. They have a number of promising underlying stats at 5-on-5. You know, they're a top 10 possession team. They're a top 10 in expected goals. Their power play has been mediocre so far. And I think a lot of people will point to the points percent or the shooting percentage on the power play, which is one of the lower marks in the league. So you sit there and say, all right, they have way too much talent for the power play struggles to continue, which I would by and large agree with. But I do think that there's a few notable things at play here. One, they have really, really bad depth issues. Like Noel Achari is making $2 million a season for 3 years. And he was never really much of a producer in the first place. Like he had a contract year last year. Like he was good last year, but that his production, which was modest at best, was out of the norm for what he is usually capable of doing. He has 0 points in 9 games start the season. Jeff Carter has 0 points in 9 games start the season. Matt Nieto has 0 points in 9 games start the season. Like that's half their bottom six. They are getting some production from the top of their lineup, their top guys. And ultimately, I look at their team and say, yeah, I think that they will figure it out. Like, there's no way that they're going to be the 29th ranked team in the league when we're all said and done. I mean, there is a way, but it's highly unlikely that they're going to be that bad of a team. But now I kind of add it in and go, this to me is like, they're one of the oldest teams in the league. Like them and Washington are the two oldest. We already see what's happening with Washington. So I think one, that there's some natural decline coming into play of just, you know, the guys aren't as good as they once were. And two, are they going to stay healthy? Like now they've dug themselves a little bit of a hole and they need to be really good. And I question if their top guys are going to stay healthy enough in order for them to do what they need to do to climb back up the standing. So I see the, you know, advanced stats. I think the depth issues are real. I think the potential injury concerns are real. And to me, that leaves them, you know, they were my team that I picked as the most difficult one to coach when we talked about it earlier. Like, this is a large part why they have vets that expect to win. I don't think they're as good as they think that they are anymore. And they've already dug themselves into a tough spot.
Yeah, I think you're right on a couple important points here. One is the bottom six issues. Like the bottom six has done nothing for this team. And it's outside of Jeff Carter, like it's a wholly imported group of forwards that have come in. And none of them have looked good and none of them have really done anything. The other thing is the injuries, as you bring up as well. Like when you have that old team, what you're hoping for is you get out to a great start, you bank wins, and then maybe down the stretch you're able to rest guys, give them less ice time. Like you don't want to be chasing and old. That's a difficult position to be because like each win becomes more valuable. Now you might be pushing your guys from an ice time perspective, but you might be chasing games where if you're well up in the standings, you don't, you know, you have the luxury to be like, you know what, we're going to wave the white flag on this 3-goal deficit in the second period here, essentially. And that's not going to happen for this team now. And they're already in a tough spot in the standings, right? Like you think about Carolina, the Rangers, the Devils, like those are pretty easy teams to lock into the top three spots of the Metro. Like none of that is guaranteed, but Hurricanes have been a little bit weird out of the gate, admittedly, but I feel pretty good about saying like, that's the way it's trending. So like, again,
I'm not worried about Carolina.
No. So that's like, it's a nice narrow road that the Penguins have to go. And that's difficult. I do think that they deserve some credit for, as you said, the fact that they have had this like this game that has worked on a possession level. Like they're shooting 8%. Their goaltending is .888 save percentage. Like that's not going to hold up. The power play should be better, although they're still figuring out the Carlson thing, I think, on a couple levels. Like the Erik Karlsson has not sort of stepped in and been like, oh, he's an incredible, like he's, no one is like, oh, he's going to win back-to-back Norris. Like there's no chatter of that so far. So like they're still figuring that component out. I think that it's an interesting thing because based on how they've played, there's a world where right now they're 6-3 and they're kind of cruising and things are going well. But like when the underlying numbers are good, you have to bank those results. And because they haven't banked those results, now they find themselves in a pretty difficult predicament here. And the top two lines are good. Like Crosby and Malkin are still good. Are you going to get 82 games from them again like you did? Like, it kind of reminds me of last year's situation a little bit, where they were very reliant on these aging stars and they miraculously got all the games from those guys. It's just so difficult to envision that happening again. And you could have said that before the season, but it's equally true now. And they now have this competitive hole to work out of as well.
They were also a top team in possession and expected goals last year, 5-on-5. And obviously they didn't make the playoffs at all. And it wasn't like the East was some massive behemoth that was insanely difficult to make the playoffs in, right? I mean, like Florida was the lowest point total of any playoff team in the league last year. So some of it, I don't want to say that they're gaming the numbers, but I do think to some degree people fall back on them. But it's like, well, if they're a top 10 team again in these numbers and they again don't make the playoffs and it's, you know, 2 years in a row, at some point, I don't know if you can just shrug and be like, oh, look at the numbers. Like they're good. Like at what point is it like, well, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, that's the issue we're dealing with the Calgary Flames, right? Like last year, the Flames had all these great underlying numbers and they seemed to control the play and they're outshooting opponents all day long. And we thought, well, that can't possibly happen again. And, you know, these guys are going to be better. And I know we're talking about the Penguins here, but like, it is the similar premise, right? Like there are teams that seem to do well by these metrics. And like, you know, the Penguins, I believe right now, as we record, are outshooting opponents by 36 to 28.8. So that's a big margin. When a team is putting up that margin, I generally feel pretty good about what they're doing. But now, you know, Calgary's is this example where like over the last year and a bit, you're seeing the same results where the goaltending isn't there, the shooting isn't there. The difference with Calgary and Pittsburgh is like Pittsburgh's got Crosby and Malkin and some of these guys. Yeah. Like with Calgary, you could always say like, oh, those guys might have the organized game, but they don't have the finishers to make it work. And that's the reason for these numbers. With the Penguins, I don't feel quite as confident in the like, oh, there's a reason why we're seeing what we're seeing statistically, because it'd be hard to argue that they don't have guys who can finish on this team, not in the bottom six, clearly, but at the top of the lineup and, you know, with Erik Karlsson and with Chris Letang as well, to some extent.
Yeah. And I also think they, a few kind of cardinal sins on the overall roster construction. I think that they have two guys that are competing top power play quarterbacks in Letang and Karlsson. And ultimately that's just not, personally, a situation that I think it fails more often than it succeeds, unless you're going to actively just pair them together on the top unit. I think when you have a guy whose bread and butter is power play and now you're telling him to not play on the power play, I think it hurts. I think we've seen it in Toronto a number of times when Tyson Barrie was acquired and now with John Klingberg, and it's like this weird, awkward dance between, all right, who gets to be the guy, and is it to make one guy feel better or is it based on merit? And I think for Karlsson in particular, on the second part, I think a lot of people just de facto point to the fact that he won the Norris last year. And I think a lot of people, including the people who voted him to win the Norris, didn't really watch much of Erik Karlsson last season. I don't think people were going out of their way to watch San Jose games. I don't think people were going in their way to watch San Jose games. So by and large, what I think happened, as someone who sadly did watch a decent chunk of San Jose games last year, is Karlsson basically did whatever he wanted on the Sharks because they were so bad that he could justify it. You know, it's like, I'm blowing the zone as a defenseman and I'm going to go join the rush and do whatever I want. And like, maybe I'll score and like, maybe I won't, and they'll score or they'll get a scoring chance or whatever the case is. You know, like some of the high risk plays essentially that were built into his game as a byproduct of playing on a really bad team were very evident to me, which in part led to him having such a massive productive season that he did, which kudos to him. That was a bad team and he produced great numbers. But now I think that he's playing on a real team and there's a real kind of set way to play. I think he's caught a little bit sometimes deferring to other top players that he didn't previously have in San Jose. Like it was easy for him to get the puck in San Jose and be like,
well, what's the alternative, right? Yeah. Like if he doesn't take that risk, it's a bum who's going to get the opportunity. Yeah. So he's like, this is our best chances for me to jump in here and try and do something. And in Pittsburgh, it's different.
Yeah. And no one was going to argue with him, right? But even the end of the Anaheim game, they had the 5-on-3 at the end. Carlson's pass gets picked off by Henrique, and Mason McTavish comes out of the box, gets the goal, which was still shorthanded because they were on a 5-on-4 technically at that point. They win the game with like 13 seconds left. And if you watch Carlson, like, he could have just turned and walked in and shot it. But it's like, oh, well, that's Evgeny Malkin at the top. Like, I got to pass it to him. And that was the easiest play for Henrique to make on that entire 5-on-3 of anybody. Like, just a little, like, one-handed tap. It was nothing, right? Because he's not... It's a bit of a weird feeling out process. So ultimately, I think he'll figure it out a little bit. He's too good not to. It's not like he hasn't been productive. Like, he has 6 points in 9 games. That's, for most defensemen, that's a really good start to the season. But I do think it's a bit of a weird, like, song and dance. And then the last thing is like, obviously the depth issues I've already talked about. So it's like, you've committed money in term to a goalie who really has had one really good season in my eyes. Like, when he started 58 games and was like .919 save percentage, that's a really good season. He had one season where it was a slightly better save percentage, but he played like 33 games, which to me is like great, but you were more of a backup. And then after that, he hasn't really been good. So you committed money to that guy. You've added in a bunch of depth guys that aren't producing, and you have a bit of a weird fit between your marquee addition and your leftover in, or your holdover incumbent in Chris Letang. And it's just been a really awkward fit that hasn't come together so far.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can both agree they'll probably be better than this. What's going to matter is just how much better and whether that's enough to pull them ahead and get them in a playoff spot and avoid what happened last year. I think that's 100% an open question at this point. Anthony, I think you would agree that one of the strangest teams we've seen so far in this NHL season is the Tampa Bay Lightning. Not because of the results. Like, if you showed me the record and said, this is what the Lightning are going to do, I'd be like, sure. Yeah, that kind of makes sense. But more because you thought that the goaltending was going to be this huge issue with Vasilevsky out and them not having an established backup, which no one can really afford, but you especially can't afford if you're paying Andrei Vasilevsky. And that the play in front of the goaltender would be strong enough that they'd still win their fair share of games. Maybe not sort of peak Lightning type like they used to be, but still like a solid team, a lot of the pieces still in place. And what we've seen is the goaltending been pretty damn good. And from a sort of possession expected goal standpoint, like whatever metric you want to use, the Lightning have just not played well in front of them. And they are lucky that they're getting the goaltending they're getting, and they're getting the shooting luck, to be honest, that they're getting as well. I think their shooting percentage is around 12% as we record today. Like, that's pretty hard to sustain over a long period of time. And the Lightning are somehow surviving, but it's unclear how long that's going to continue.
Yeah, they are a strange team. So obviously you referenced the poor 5-on-5 numbers. One thing that I thought a lot about coming into this conversation was what we actually talked about a few episodes ago, which was them changing their defensive zone structure, right? Like, there is a learning curve for that. So on the glass half full side, you could sit there and say they are still banking points. They're not Pittsburgh Penguining it in this process. They, you know, they're giving themselves some cushion to play with, and they're working through the kinks. Like, John Cooper would be the first one to probably sit here and say, like, we're not playing for October and November. We are playing for spring and the playoffs. So collecting the points, working through the issues, I think those are all like positive signs for them that they can take and build on. I think the biggest like drawback that I see when I look at it is that like they're at minimum a forward short, right? Like, Nikita Kucherov is currently on pace to have his highest career time on ice ever. And, you know, he's not young anymore.
He's not a spring chicken, that's for sure.
Like, he's 30, like he's turning 31. In next June, to be fair. But like, someone who's 30, are you looking saying, let's have this 30-year-old winger play more than he's ever played before in the league? Right? Because otherwise, if you look at their time on ice average of their players, guys are kind of where you would expect them to be. Brayden Point's a little bit over 20 minutes. Stamkos and Sorelli are, you know, 1842, 1835. Brandon Hagel, 1743. Nick Paul, 1610. Tanner Janot's a little over 14. Like, none of those numbers are particularly egregious. Like, you can generally look at them and say, like, yeah, I could see how those guys would play in those time slots. Like, maybe Sorelli could play a little bit more. But by and large, it's just a byproduct to me of like, they don't have enough horses. And that's what happens when you lose, you know, last summer it was Alex Killorn and Ross Colton. This, you know, before that it was Andre Pilat. Before that, you know, Yanni Gore, Blake Coleman, like Barclay Goodrow. Like you keep losing these guys, and no team in the cap era can backfill for that.
No, I mean, you'd have to be an insane player development team to do it, and you're doing that with limited draft picks. We know the Lightning love to trade away their draft picks. You could argue with how they've done that at times. There's been successes and failures at that. Killorn is a guy I think they really miss, right? Like, Cirelli is someone who has not really produced out of the gate, and him with Killorn and Hagel was a really, really effective line at times last year. Like, that... You know, that's a line you're scared of as well. And right now you're kind of scared of
Killorn
that.
Killorn had
first...
a massive contract year too. Like a massive.
Oh yeah. Contract. Like, yeah. I mean, the year you got from him wasn't necessarily the year you would get from him if you had him this year. He's been injured. But I think it's just different. It's a different feel from when you had sort of that 1-2 punch to the one. The gap between 1 and 2 is bigger now. And the Stamkos, you know, you're still scared of Stamkos and Point and Kucherov. Yeah. Stamkos has had some weird results, like some weird numbers. Like on ice right now, the 5-on-5, the Lightning are getting outshot 75-38 when Stamkos is on the ice at 5-on-5, which is pretty ugly. Insane number to have a guy getting filled in to that extent. It's not quite as bad for Point and Kucherov, but it's not good either. Like, there are two guys on the
and he has 8 points in 7 games. That's probably the funniest part of that stat.
Yeah. It's bizarre. And there are two guys on this entire team with expected goal above 50% at 5-on-5. So I'm with you that they're working some things out. It is really important that they're banking points, right? Because getting Vasilevskiy back can only make them a better team. You know, there's a little bit of a difficult to quantify component there too, about how a team plays in front of a goaltender that they have that level of confidence in. Like that's always been part of the Lightning secret sauce. I think the fact that they always had Vasilevskiy back there and it kind of empowered the team to take certain risks. And so that'll be that's going to put upwards pressure on their win total, on their point total. So when you look at this stuff, I don't think you say, oh, this is a reason to panic. This team is about to crumble. This team is aged out of its window. I think the talk of the Lightning being old is a little bit overstated, to be honest. Like, they're not ancient in the same way the Penguins are. A lot of these guys are still very much in their primes. But I don't know. I think it's a situation where if in 10, 15 games, we're still looking at it and this team is consistently getting beat 5-on-5 in terms of shots and chances, things like that, then we can reevaluate what do we think of the Tampa Bay Lightning as a team. But for now, it seems like they're weathering a difficult situation surprisingly well, with a little bit of luck, arguably. And they're putting themselves in a position to compete for a playoff spot, which a lot of people coming into the season did not have the Lightning as a playoff team. And maybe that some of that is a little bit of takery. Like it's kind of like, I don't know, makes you look good to be like, all right, yeah, I'm going to say this thing that other people aren't going to say. It's not like they made the playoffs by a mile last year. So it's not a wild prediction, I guess. But I think if you came this year not liking the Lightning, you have evidence to support your argument, but it seems early to really turn on this team.
Yeah, and honestly, the last thing I'll note, just because we haven't really talked about it on the other side, is their defense, right? Like, Darren Radish is in their top four, and he's promising. I thought he looked really, really good in the playoffs last year. You know, he came into the season with 21 games under his name. Like, there is a learning curve to playing in the top four every night. Yeah, I mean, they've been loading up Mikhail Sergachev for years now, and he is a good player, but I also think there's a lot of risk, like sloppy risk to his game. Like
that's what coaches love to hear, risk. Sloppy risk.
Yeah, like there's a play or two a game where you kind of scratch your head that he's participated in some capacity. And previously they did have the horses to kind of insulate that and look for ways to, you know, make it not as problematic, but I think they need a lot from him now. Right, like Nick Perbix is in his second year. I don't think Eric Cernak, who obviously got knocked out of the playoffs last year and is playing for the first time since, like, I don't think he's been his best. I think the defense can somewhat turn around and maybe get better as things go along, but you know, they're a big reason too. We can talk about them missing a forward, and which is still true, but I think their defense needs to, you know, kind of round into shape. I think they will to some degree, but
the ceiling's probably not there. You know, like you talk about that kind of like peak lightning, the ceiling for this defense group probably isn't as high as it was for some of those peak lightning teams. Like I know they have some of those younger guys, but a lot of those, or guys getting used to it, like Perbix, like Radish, like those guys are kind of newer, but that doesn't mean that they're like massive high ceiling phenom type guys. Like they're guys that project to be solid and could improve, but they're not sort of up and coming superstars. Cause as the Lightning, again, where are you going to get these young superstars from? You never take any draft picks. And even if you did, they're late draft picks. So there isn't a wave of super high ceiling players coming to the Lightning. Like, this is a team that's in decline. It's just like, is the decline slow enough that they're still pretty good? And for now, despite some of these red flags, it does seem that way, that this is still a pretty good team.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.